Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safarik.
And I'm Greg Lindsay. And regular listeners know that we're just a couple of suburban Chicago boys who like to have occasional Chicago episodes, and this is one of them. Dan, who is our guest today?
Our guest today is Lawrence, otherwise known as Larry Booth, who founded Booth Hansen in 1980 with the belief that spirited, meaningful, and useful buildings can be realized with an organized and open creative process. As design principal, he leads the conceptual development of every project at the firm, always beginning with the conviction that each client, landscape, and building program is unique and demands knowledge and creativity to achieve the best results. In a career spanning more than 50 years, Larry has been awarded numerous honors for his design work. And that, of course, that resume does go on, but let's cut right to it. Welcome, Larry.
Thank you for coming. Looking forward to talking to you, Dan. It's always good to talk about architecture. That's one of the things I think is very important, not only in getting the message out, but also working with clients and working with people to develop building designs.
Indeed, and so few buildings are designed by architects these days. We have to stake our claim where we can.
Well, architects are always looking for work.
That's certainly true.
That's true.
So let's talk a little bit about this with the occasion of our visit here today. There is a new book out about your work, your career, called Modern Beyond Style and the Pursuit of Beauty. The author is Jay Pridmore. What prompted you to do a book at this particular time?
Well, it took a while, and Jay was very patient because I wasn't sure what I wanted to say. And that's what prompted the book, because we've been in practice since 1966 and started Booth Hansen in 1980, as you said. And we got into a question of, if you're in an elevator and someone asks you, what kind of architecture do you do? What do you say? And after thinking about it a long time, I said, well, I'm not sure what if I'm saying enough or if I'm saying too much or. So why don't we look through all this and write a serious book and come about trying to explain what Booth Hansen had been doing for a long time. And it was a great exercise. I think Jay rewrote it about six times. And I think we finally got it. So it's a readable message if people are interested in architecture.
Yeah, I would say it reads very well. It's very accessible, and that is kind of remarkable because, you know, one of the sort of facets of the era in which you came to prominence was the beginning of a real discussion about whether we could break as Chicago architects free from the chains of Mies van der Rohe and the international style. Not to say that we don't admire that work, but there was something going on in the late 70s where the old adage of, you know, build, don't talk, was starting to be pushed aside, and people started talking. The architects in practice started talking. Can you describe a little bit what that situation was like when the Chicago Seven were formed?
Well, we were the Young Turks, and we were obviously trying to shake things up a little bit to get ourselves noticed, get some work, and make architecture better. Because in the 50s and the 60s, it was pretty mechanistic. It was pretty form followed function. Once you figured out where to put the doors and windows, then that was it. You had it, and buildings got to be awfully boring. As my friend Stanley Tigerman used to say, boring. And so we wanted to shake things up. And a group of the Mesians developed a show about Chicago architecture that really the proposition was that Mies was really the inheritor of the Chicago School of Architecture. You know, Sullivan and Root, Burnham, and the great Chicago architects at the turn of the century from the 19th to the 20th. And we took umbrage to that. We said, hey, wait a minute. There's a lot more to Chicago architecture than this mechanistic Mesian architecture. These buildings are fine buildings, but there's a lot more to Chicago architecture. And we started collecting images. And one thing led to another. And pretty soon we had 100 or so images of great Chicago buildings that had nothing to do with Mies van der Rohe, although he was welcome to join the crowd that did great buildings, because that's what Chicago is about, is great architecture. Not like many towns where the cab drivers don't know the architects. Well, Chicago, the cab drivers know the architects. So we developed then a show in competition with this show from IIT and Mies van der Rohe's crowd that was going in the Museum of Contemporary Art, which at that time was on Ontario Street. So we got the lobby of the Time Life building, which was half a block away, and we put up this show, and the show actually opened in New York. And that was one of our media ideas. If it comes from New York, it has a certain authority. So we opened at Cooper Union in New York. Haydock was the dean there, and he gave us the lobby of the school of Cooper Union. And so we put the show on there and then brought it to the Time Life lobby. At the same time, the show was at the opposite show was at the Museum of Contemporary Art. And as I think everybody knows, the press and the media love an argument. And so this got a lot of attention. The New York Times gave us a little article, and we created the argument that Chicago architecture was very pluralistic and rich and not limited to this mechanistic architecture of the IIT Mies crowd. So we created a fuss, and people took notice. And we, after that, came up with the idea. This was during the trial of the Chicago Seven, who had disrupted the Democratic Convention in Chicago. And so we tagged onto that name, and that's how we got called the Chicago Seven. There happened to be seven of us for a while. Then it grew to 11 or something, but we kept the name.
That's extraordinary. It's quite ironic, too, that your exhibition was held in the lobby of the Time Life building, considering that that was at least a Mies inheritance.
Well, Harry Weiss really did it, and it was copper and had gold glass, so it was a little bit edgy.
And then, of course, you went on to design the first real permanent home of the Museum of Contemporary Art, which I do remember. I remember that building. I saw Andres Serrano's Piss Christ there.
Oh, yeah. That was a lovely little building. And I was sorry when they tore it down, because it did have, at that time, accessibility was just becoming into focus. And we did the entry to that as a accessible ramp was its noticeable facade on the front. And I remember Dr. Betts thought I was a hero Dr. Betts invented, and he didn't invent, but he led the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago. And he was a very great champion of accessibility.
Well, that's also, again, making me think that it's somewhat. Do you think that it's ironic that the replacement building for MCA has this enormous, enormous formal staircase going up into the throne of art? And, of course, you can access it by the corners. But what do you think of the replacement design?
Well, I shouldn't. What I think of it is politically totally incorrect, so I won't I won't make a snide remark. But I think it was important that the institution get a larger space so it could grow and provide the community of Chicago access to a lot of art that the Art Institute couldn't accept. So I think it's great that they did it. And I think the stairs are a little off-putting. They could have made them a little more interesting. Like there's a current staircase fad in larger institutional buildings now that they build these institutional. We did one down in Champaign where it's a staircase where people can sit in various. It's more like the Spanish stair in Rome than it is the stern courthouse-looking staircase that the MCA has.
There's an anonymous architect on Twitter who refers to those as big stairs for sitting. So, yes, there became quite the fad for that.
Yeah, big stairs for sitting.
Well, one thing I want to ask Larry is, Dan and I were chatting beforehand, you know, that in your time with the Chicago 7, there was a time in architecture, I think, when it had an outsized role in the American imagination, where you had the Chicago 7, you had groups in New York like the Whites versus the Grays. I'm curious your thoughts now on sort of the Chicago scene of architects. I did not know until recently, for example, that Jeannie Gang came up through your office. I mean, we know her as one of the baby Rems, you know, who spent time in OMA. And I'm curious, what do you think of when you see the landscape of current practitioners in Chicago? Like, is there still that sort of community that there was in your time? And is that important for Chicago to have a recognizable Chicago style by practitioners in the city versus the real international landscape of firms that we, of course, see everywhere else?
Well, I'm not the one to really speak about the current energy of the younger set, because now I'm the target. So I'm the part of the establishment. But I think there's we started the Chicago Architectural Club, which was another vehicle for architects to get together and to talk and to have arguments and various presentations. And I'm not sure that's going on. I've lost track. As you get older, you get used to things the way you're doing it and kind of focus on what you're doing. But I had lunch the other day with a young group that had left the office about 5 years ago, and they're doing great. They bought a 2-flat in the north side, and they have the office on the ground floor, and they have their apartment above, and they've got a staff of 5, and in their words, the team is really the best team they've had, and they're really doing some great work. So I think that's going around all around Chicago. There are a lot of little firms, and what we argued is literally happening. It's pluralistic. There's no argument now because everything is acceptable. And some of the newer buildings, you know, I look at and say, well, boy, I wouldn't do that. But this is what's happening, and I think it's healthy.
No, absolutely. Well, I want to return to, obviously, the style and, of course, your work in a second. But I'm always interested in having longtime practitioners, how the style of your practice has changed. Of course, there's so much discussion in the architecture world about exploitation. There's, of course, raging debates about unionization things. And, of course, and then there's just how the whole practice changed, you know, with OMA and some of the other firms of, like, principals globetrotting the world while associates ground out forms. I'm curious how your own approach to the actual work and how the organization of Booth Hansen has changed over the last 40 years or so.
Well, when we started, we started as Booth Nagel, and Jim Nagel and I started, and we happened to hit a few projects like the Arco gas station and a couple of houses that got noticed in Architectural Record Homes. So we were very fortunate. And at that time, there were many large firms in Chicago, Skidmore, and Merritt, Hollibaird and Root, Perkins and Will, Schmidt, Garden and Erickson, Graham Anderson, Probst and White. There were a lot of these established firms that were large, and there were a lot of little projects floating around that we were able to get a few, and we were able to really prosper as a small architectural firm. And then, of course, we wanted to grow and we wanted to do other things. So we continued to do small. We still do. We just did a tiny halfway house in a Chicagoland golf course that was really a lot of fun and turned out great. So small projects are still interesting. And at the same time, we're doing this large, we're part of a team that's doing a large computer science building for the University of Illinois in Chicago. So there's a lot of things that happen to you if you hang around.
So looking back on this arc, you know, that started, you know, with the Chicago 7, et cetera, going forward, do you consider yourself to be a postmodernist? Do you resist that label? What would a postmodernist look like to you, and how is that different or similar to what you've been executing over the past few decades?
Well, this is kind of what the book addresses. Postmodernism actually was a reaction against this idea that tradition and modernism were antithetical. And it said that, yes, you can employ the past architecture. The only problem is they did it in a way that was not, they were not convinced about. They did not believe in postmodernism. It was a cartoon taking little bits and pieces of the past and sticking them on a modern building and being kind of glib about it. And therefore, since the architects weren't convinced, the public wasn't convinced, and it faded very quickly. It was surprisingly how quickly it faded. I think Philip Johnson's AT&T building was on the cover of Time, and then 2 years later, no one wanted to talk about postmodernism. So postmodernism was not the way to go. And in 1980, Paul Hansen and I started Booth Hansen. And the idea behind that was, hey, architects tended to be kind of sloppy in their business practices. They weren't dependable. Architects were kind of flaky. They were somewhat caught between art and science and didn't know quite where to go. And then they had to run a business, and they weren't interested in that. So Paul Hansen had a degree from the University of Chicago Business School. So we started Booth Hansen, and we meant business. As much as as architects could. He was much more business-minded than I was. But I was convinced that you could do creative work methodically, have a discipline, have it organized so that the client was served in a way that was efficient and productive, that it wasn't it was not a problem with creativity to be organized. It, in fact, creativity could be advanced with an organized approach to the design of buildings. So we started Booth Hansen on that basis. And the first thing we did, we had a checklist. So just like when you fly an airplane, you have a checklist to make sure you don't throw the wrong switch. And we had a checklist that has developed over the years into a, we have a pompous name for it, quality track system. But it it's a way of checking and make sure that you don't get out ahead of yourself and miss something and then all of a sudden have to go back. So, and even doctors now do that in operating rooms. They have checklists. So we thought that the checklist was the answer. And over the years, we've improved it. And then recently, I developed this idea of the compass points, which are sort of 12 little phrases that can stimulate thinking at various times during the course of the design process, because it takes about 6 months. It can take 6 months, it can take 3 months, but it takes some time to develop the design of a building. So the compass points kind of push you in the right direction during the course of this process. It's not a map, but it's a compass. So you know where you are, and you kind of know what you have to do at any given time. So it's like navigating a boat across an ocean. You've got to know where you are. So that is beginning to show some promise. One of the key items is sweat the details. And you sweating the details is really critical to doing a fine building, because you can't, it all has to fit together like a Swiss watch, or it should fit together like a Swiss watch. And it should be beautiful. And that's one of the compass points, is simplify for beauty. And the other, one of the other important ones is dialogue. You have to talk to the client a lot, and the client has to talk to you, and the consultants have to talk to you, and you have to talk to the consultants, and the contractors have to talk to you, and you have to talk to the contractors. You can learn from the contractors. Contractors can be a big help in developing the design, because it's important. The methodology of construction has a big impact on the cost of buildings. So if you want a building to be built efficiently, you have to have knowledge that comes from the contractors. And of course, the client, if anybody knows what the building ought to be, it better be the client. If they don't know what they want or what they need, then they're probably not going to get it. So it's very important to talk a lot to the client and learn from the client what it is they, what are their goals, what are they trying to do, and how can we help them make that happen. So the development of the process came and in the book. It starts with buildings ought to be systematic. They ought to be like natural plants and geologies. There's a system to all of nature. So plants become part of that, and they should be systematic. And to get the proper systems, you have to have a process of inventing a building that has the proper systems. So those are the two, first two, the idea of system and then process. And then that goes on to total performance. We began to think about buildings. We should think about buildings like we think about race cars or airplanes. Just because they move doesn't mean that they don't have design demands and design ideas that allow them to do what they do. So then we started after that to think about spirit, which is the humanistic, that it can't be mechanistic. If you just went with system and process, it could become mechanistic. But if you don't have the spirit of the client and the place where the building's going, it won't be as good as it might be. It won't be as beautiful, and beauty is another point in the book category. We're trying to do beautiful buildings. And beauty has been shortchanged in today's world. One time I learned that, I went to a lecture at the Art Institute, and it was by this artist in New York, and he had been in Chicago during the Biennale when he was going to give this lecture. And he lectured about beauty. He mentioned beauty. He said, you know, it was really interesting. I went over to the Biennale, the architectural Biennale, and I went through every exhibit. I read just about everything I could, and the word beauty never occurred. So that was so memorable to me. I mean, that sticks with me, is we as architects are not interested in beauty. So how do you get beautiful buildings if the architects are not interested in beauty? So, I mean, we're interested in, that's one thing about today, I will say. Architects are interested in an awful lot of things now. It's very pluralistic. They're interested in sociology, in anthropology, and the raft of things that they're interested in is fascinating. But I think we got to focus on where we can to make beautiful places for people that they enjoy and treasure. I think that should be a serious main focus. And there's a lot of arguments about beauty. But I believe it's an absolute. It's not just something in your eye. It involves your whole person. It involves your eye, and then it involves your brain, because your brain processes the visual information, and it involves eventually your soul, if you think you have one. So beauty is something that is real. And it exists like truth and goodness and beauty. So that's one of the things that I tried to get through in the book. And that's why the subtitle is The Pursuit of Beauty, because you can't explain beauty necessarily, and you can't own it. It's something you can only pursue. And I think that's a good message to the profession and to the clients and to the public. It's important to pursue it. You may not get it every time, because it takes a lot of effort.
I like this idea that, you know, you think of architecture as something that benefits from being disciplined, but the failure of over discipline or over dogmatic approach is that it becomes mechanistic, and you lose sight of, you know, principles of beauty and ideals and ideas. Do you think that the, you know, mentioning having seen the Biennale and both the Chicago and the more internationally famous Venice Biennale, I'd noticed over the years have become, to my eye, a little bit less about architecture principles and more about some of the other ideas that architects are interested in. You know, as you mentioned, sociology, what's going on in society, making commentary, kind of blurring the line really between architecture and art, but from a not necessarily from a fundamental principles standpoint, but more like from a need to make a statement. Do you think that there is a crisis in architecture where architects are struggling to be heard through their actual built work, and there needs to be some kind of other venue for them to express themselves. I'm curious, having been around for a while, what you think is going on.
Yeah, what do I think is going on? When you were speaking, it struck me that's basically that's what I said a little earlier, that architects are interested in damn near everything. And I think it's important that architects be interested in everything, but I think because they want to be relevant, they have to be knowledgeable about what's going on in politics and law and business. And I mean, there's all kinds of things that touch architecture. And certainly, you certainly get a lot of opinions when you do build a building that people, I like it or I don't like it, or that's beautiful or no, that's really stupid. So you get a range of feedback that is very varied. But the idea of making architecture relevant by engaging, don't forget that what we do is build buildings, and the buildings stand there, and nobody's standing in front of it explaining to you what the ideas are, what you're trying to communicate in the building, and how you're trying to give it some meaning and some relevance to where it is and who built it and who used it. And if we lose track of our main occupation, if you will, I think that's not necessarily a good direction. Whereas we don't want to be amateur sociologists or political scientists or philosophers. We don't want to be amateur anything else. We want to be professional architects who do great buildings. And I think that's got to be the focus.
Larry Booth, thank you so much. Thank you for joining Unfrozen. This has been Larry Booth, founder of Booth Hansen Architects in Chicago, and the subject of the new book, Modern Beyond Style and the Pursuit of Beauty. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, guys. I enjoyed it.